Okay, good evening. Welcome, everyone, to the 529 Emergency Preparedness Discussion at courtesy of the WA7ABU 529 Repeater. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. My name is Brett, and I'm net control for today, Friday, March 27th, 2020. This is a special edition of the Emergency Preparedness Net, which normally meets on Tuesday evenings. We'll meet again next Tuesday from 7 to 8 p.m. But tonight is a special topic with talking about COVID-19 and answering your questions. We have, again, our guest, Sheila Sund, MD, who has a new blog entry on her blog, disasterdoc.net. That's Delta, India, Sierra, Alpha, Sierra, Tango, Echo, Romeo, dot November, Echo, Tango. So if you want to read her latest article on that, it is on COVID-proof your home, is the title of the talk. And we'll go over some things about coronaviruses and the environment, and we'll be answering your questions on that topic tonight, as well as other ones you might have. Go on with my preamble here. This, of course, is a designated emergency frequency and will break if any real emergency occurs. Our alternate frequency is 145.19 with a tone of 100. We appreciate those who stand by and allow us to have a clear frequency for the next hour as we go over the COVID-19 question and answer session. Now, tonight what I'd like to do is I'm going to keep the check-ins down to about 10 minutes. That way we have time for your questions. So we'll just take a few check-ins, make sure there's no pressing announcements, and then if you have a question and you haven't already checked in, you can go ahead and give your call sign and say you have a question, and we'll mark you down so that way it'll go a little faster. Okay. So anyway, you're all welcome to participate and or just listen in. And again, no such thing as dumb question on this net or any of our other nets on the 529.
Kilo Alpha 7 Juliet Lima Oscar Jeff in Albany.
Canon RCP with a comment.
Okay, 6 for your Tango X-ray.
So, are you not hearing me? Go ahead with your comment there, RCP.
Yeah, I was going to say real fast. People might want to, especially the people that don't have access to ham radio equipment, friends, families, things of that nature, with this net being a real good source of COVID-19 information, is link them to the WA7ABU.com website and tell them to click on the web player there. That way people that don't have access to radios can still listen to this net. So just word, because, you know, not everybody has a radio. K9RCP.
Okay, thank you, Richard, for your comment. I already got you checked in there. Kilo 9, Romeo, Charlie, Papa, and Jeff, I checked you in. Kilo Alpha 7, Juliet, Lima, Oscar. But let's pause for just a minute here and see if there's anybody on Echo Link that would like to check in for the net.
K7, Juliet, Charlie, Delta, Echo Link. That's the player at the bottom of the page that you want to click on.
Okay, net recognizes John, Kilo 7, Juliet, Charlie, Delta. And yes, what Richard was referring to, if you go to Whiskey Alpha 7 Alpha Bravo Uniform.com, Charlie, Oscar, Mike, there is a real-time streaming audio player at the bottom of the page on the left-hand side is the one for the 529. And you can, where your relatives or friends or even, non-ham radio people can all stream that through their various phones, tablets, and computers and listen to with a slight delay, but it's there. And then later on, we'll have a recording of the whole conversation available. Last week's is at the top of the page. Okay, let's take a few more check-ins. I'm going to go till 10 after the check-ins, and then we're going to go to questions, okay? This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. Any check-ins?
Whiskey 7, Charlie, Mike.
Okay, 6, your Tango X-ray.
And Victor, India, November Mobile. Kevin, here in Salem.
Whiskey 7, Tango Delta November, Trent, Dallas, handheld.
Whiskey 7, Mike Tango Lima.
Whiskey 0, Echo Delta Foxtrot, Richard and Tiger.
And November 0, November, November, Oscar.
November 7, India Mike Echo.
Okay, let's pause for just a second there. November 7, India Mike Echo. Did I get that right? I think you're new to MyNet. Could you come back with your confirmation of that and your name, please?
You did copy it correctly. This is Jason in Dallas.
Okay, Jason, I got you checked in. Thank you for joining us this evening. Anybody else want to check in for the emergency preparedness event?
Kilo, Juliet, 7. Juliet, Yankee, Juliet, Jeff in Washougal.
Kilo, Juliet, 7. Charlie, November, Lima. The name is Matt, Mike Alpha Tango Tango from West Eugene.
Kilo, India, 7, Delta, Sierra, Lima. Polo from Brooks.
Good evening. This is Whiskey 7, Alpha Kilo Golf, Doug in Woodland, Washington.
Okay, let's pause there because I need to actually... I skipped over when I got did Jason there. That was... I'm going to work backwards here, so if you did... hopefully we'll catch everybody this time. Whiskey 7, Alpha Kilo Golf, that was Doug. Kilo India 7, Delta Sierra Lima, that's Polo. Matt was Kilo Juliet 7, Charlie November Lena. We had Jeff... Whiskey 7, Tango Delta, November. Kevin was in there. Kilo 1, Victor, India, November. Dan, Kilo 6, Sierra Tango, X-Ray. Bruce, Whiskey 7, Charlie, Mike. And I think we got John on Echolink earlier. There we go. That's a mouthful. Anybody else want to check in?
Good evening. Whiskey 7, India, Victor, November. Ivan, Albany.
Okay, there's Ivan, Whiskey 7, India, Victor, November. Again, this is the Emergency Preparedness Net Special Edition, Friday evening here, talking about COVID-19 with Sheila Sun, MD. And you can look at disasterdoc.net, just like the word disaster, doc.net. And we're going to be talking about COVID-19 in the environment and around your home. And so... anyway, just take a couple minute or so more of check-ins, and also if there's anybody has any announcements that would like to come, that would be good as well.
From my kitchen, here is Kilo Golf 7, Charlie Kilo Oscar.
Okay, I've got James there, Kilo Golf 7, Charlie Kilo Oscar. Malala. Thank you for checking in. Okay, so let's see. Last minute of check-ins and announcements here before we move on with our topic tonight.
Whiskey Alpha 7, Alpha Bravo Uniform.
Okay, and there's Dan, Whiskey Alpha 7, Alpha Bravo Uniform. Did you have an announcement for us tonight, Dan?
No, I don't think so. I don't want to take up any extra time. WA7ABU.
Okay, so without further ado, I guess what we're going to do is I'm going to go ahead and introduce Sheila Sun, MD, who has been our guest speaker the last couple of sessions. I think it's gone pretty well. Again, if you have questions for Dr. Sun, she's going to talk a little bit about her topic, and then we'll take questions and try to do like one question at a time here. And if you haven't checked in, that's okay. If you want to make it, you know, go ahead and say, check in with your call and say you have a question, we'll recognize you. Anyway, I'm going to introduce Sheila here, and she'll talk about tonight's topic here for you. KG7GDB, and here's Sheila.
Hello, everyone. I want to start with a few updates of some things that we've learned more about the medical aspects of COVID-19, because I think they're helpful. I think the most important thing is that we used to say, watch for a fever and a cough. That's probably not true. A lot of people that are getting it really just are mildly sick. They feel a little off. They feel like they have a cold. They might be coming down with something. And it's not until later on that they get the fever or the cough, if they get it at all. So I just want to encourage people that if they feel sick or off, particularly if it feels like you're coming down with something, take that seriously and self-isolate yourself in your home so that you make sure you don't infect anybody else. The other thing is just some timing of it. It looks like right now the majority of people are developing symptoms between 5 and 6 days after they're exposed. The typical time course is they feel a little bit off, sometimes for a day or two. They often feel better for a day or two, and then somewhere between around day 5 to 7, they get much, much more sick. And from there, they can go downhill very quickly and literally need to be hospitalized within 24 hours and on a ventilator. So, again, if you feel a little sick and you feel better, that doesn't necessarily mean you're home free. You might be in that little improvement window. So the current recommendations are that if you feel sick, you self-isolate for 72 hours after you have absolutely no symptom of any type whatsoever.
Okay, KG7GB. So are there any questions about the update on the symptomology of the COVID-19? Any questions on that regard about what symptoms and what to expect there?
K9 RCP.
Richard, go ahead, please.
So I found out just recently that the White House, for press to enter the building, they take their temperature, of course, but they also have you smell from two different, vials. One contains just water, the other one contains lavender, and they switch it up, with every, person that comes in. And the idea behind it is if you have COVID-19, they're finding a lot of people aren't able to smell or taste, and by them, showing which one that is, that contains the lavender smell, shows that they don't have any precursor of the more serious, like fever and stuff. And so that's one way that they're testing to make sure that the people that are coming into, the White House for press conferences are not showing symptoms, because evidently one of the symptoms is not being able to taste or smell. Back to Nat, K9 RCP.
That's been reported by some EMT groups over in Europe, the inability to taste or smell. Should comment that is not specific to COVID-19. It's actually common with many of the viruses. As you probably know, when you've had a cold, sometimes you use that. The medical profession and the infection control people around the world are not sure how good of a screen it is. It doesn't hurt. If all of a sudden you can't smell anything, I'd be a little anxious. The temperature thing we've now shown is probably not very good for screening people, even though that was used worldwide, because 50% of the people do not have a fever at the onset of symptoms. So, I mean, if you have a fever, it's bad, but the fact that you don't have a fever doesn't mean anything. We've also discovered that about 20% of the people are both infected with influenza and COVID at the same time. So even right now, many places in the United States won't test somebody if they've had a positive influenza test, and we're missing about 20% of the COVID cases because of that.
Okay, any questions or comments again on the medical side or any symptomology things, that, questions that, that you've heard about or like clarified?
Okay, 6SDX.
Okay, Dan, yeah, go ahead with your question.
Does Salem Hospital have enough testing kits for anybody that would come in?
Oregon has never had enough testing kits for anybody to come in. Oregon has, at best, for a little while, certain places will test you if you have symptoms and you get an appointment to go into a respiratory clinic and they think you're sick enough, even if you don't have to go to the hospital, you might get a test. But we have never yet had enough tests in Oregon, or even if we have the test, enough supplies to test anybody. Salem has been particularly short in the last few days of the swabs that are needed, which apparently mostly come from northern Italy, interestingly enough. And so even though we have tests, we have shortages of swabs, we have shortages of the reagents, and when you get a test, the current wait time to get a result is 3 to 6 days. That includes the hospital patient. So testing is still a huge problem throughout Oregon, not just Salem in particular.
Okay, 6SDX.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan, to follow up.
So I'm trying to determine, should I get sick? When do I make the decision to call 911 and take an ambulance ride down to the hospital? Is it once you get you can't breathe anymore? Is that when you finally decide that you got to go? It seems like that by that time it's a little bit too late. And, you know, I'm 79 years old and still have a lot of other issues. So the question for me would be, do you just wait it out until the last minute? And then if you get tested, and you're already to that stage, and you won't even know for another 4 or 5 days afterward, seems to me like it's going to be too late.
I understand completely. It's very alarming. In general, what we're recommending is if you think you might have symptoms, even if they're pretty mild, the best thing to do is to call your regular primary care provider. Just run it over with them. They won't order a test, but at least that way you're kind of plugged in. They'll tell you some things to watch for, and then you keep looking at it. If you get worse where you're starting to run high fevers, you know, 101, if you're developing shortness of breath, if you are becoming weak, if you're becoming confused, actually if you're developing what feel like heart symptoms, all of those things should prompt, if they're mild but obviously getting worse, call your primary care provider. If they're severe, you call 911. They may or may not admit you to the hospital, but at least that way you will get in and get evaluated for how sick you really are. As far as who gets admitted to the hospital, a lot of people that are that sick are still not getting admitted, depending upon how everything's look, what your oxygen level is, what your labs are. We're still needing to make people write out a lot of it at home. The major criteria for being admitted to the hospital is when we start seeing that your lungs aren't working well with your oxygen or that you're starting to have effects on other organ systems of your body.
Okay, well, I do have an oximeter here at home, so if you drop below 90, I guess that's the time to call, or what's your oxygen level that says you better ring the bell?
Well, first of all, some people won't have oxygen. So one thing I do recommend is you, when you first feel sick, check what you can do without getting short of breath. Just give yourself a little exercise test of, if I walk down the hallway, what do I feel like? And then check that regularly. And if you find that not that you're just tired, but that you're more short of breath doing the same little exertion that you than you were a couple days ago, that's a sign that it may be getting into your lungs. And if that gets, you really can't do hardly anything without shortness of breath, that's the time to call or go in and get evaluated. As far as an oxygen level, if you are normally normal and don't need oxygen all the time, definitely if you get below 90, you need to go in. There are some people that are right around 90 as baseline. They may have a little more flexibility. But yes, in general, I would say if you're below 90, it's time to go to the emergency room.
Okie doke, K6SDX.
Okay, and this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. We're on the Emergency Preparedness Net special edition with Sheila Sund, MD, answering your COVID-19 questions. So, were there any other questions about symptoms of COVID that you'd like to talk about now before we move on and talk about, the environment and Okay, so let's check and see if there's any more questions.
India Victor November.
Yes, Ivan, go ahead.
I had read and heard something about red eyes with minimal symptoms beyond that. It was from Woodland, Washington. They had noticed that the person had red eyes but had not had any difficulty breathing, but then again the next day the person was gone. Do we know anything about the red eye symptom, W7IVN?
I've read that too, but those are basically what we call anecdotal reports in people that are looking large groups of people. That is not holding up. Red eyes are not an uncommon thing with viral illness. The only thing that might explain what they had is occasionally people, when they're getting very, very seriously ill, are even developing some problems with blood clotting. And I could maybe think that they would have some hemorrhaging in their eyes with that, but that looks different than normal red eyes, and that's just theorizing on my part. It's definitely not something that they're showing as a sign that things are about to go wrong, just like red eyes, like anybody would notice.
Okay, so, and we're going to... We have a couple other topics. There was a topic last time that we wanted us to look up that talks about people, what do you need to do if you need to go to work, if you're one of these essential employees, some strategy to that. Let me have Sheila address that topic for you.
You should realize that a lot of people that can go to work can do so safely. If they are working in an outdoor environment, it's really pretty safe. The rules hold in the workplace like they do elsewhere. You really need to be having 6-foot distancing. You need to be able to wash your hands frequently, sanitize things that lots of people are talking on a fairly regular basis. And it's not an official thing, but I would worry less if you were in a big space like a grocery store than if you were working in a small space like a conference room or a small storeroom, just because we're a little uncertain about how long this virus floats around in the air. So that's what all workplaces are supposed to be looking for right now, is a way to have their employees work under those conditions safely. And if you can maintain that 6-foot distance, or you work outside and you can either wear gloves or wash your hands frequently, you're probably pretty safe in the workplace. If your workplace isn't allowing you to do that, that's a problem. If it is a truly essential thing, a truly essential business like healthcare, you lose because you need to work anyways. But if you're in one of these businesses that are calling themselves essential but maybe aren't, there's actually a way to report that to the governor's office, and they will investigate to see whether they should intervene.
OK, Yeah, we're gonna talk about what happens when you come home from work and how you establish a hot zone area where to bring things in just a bit. So we sent you off to work, and you're off to work, and you're in an essential environment. You are trying to do the social distancing. For us radio users out there, it is one group brought up the idea that it's 2 meters, and that we talk about this on the 2 meter net, and they wanted to point out that we already know all about what 2 meters is. That's how far away you need to stand for COVID, and that's your favorite repeater frequency for talking about it on as well. Any questions so far on if anybody's looked at the COVID Proof Your Home article, and last time we talked about the Home is Your Fortress article. Were there any questions on anything on the blog that you've read?
Whiskey 7 Echo, Echo Tango.
Okay, Whiskey 7 Echo Echo Tango. Gotcha. That's Gene. So go ahead with your question.
Well, it's not really a question, but it's a recommendation. Go to your doctor and request for that malaria medication that they're testing it in New York right now with all the nurses and doctors that are taking it right now. And apparently they have not gotten it yet. Nobody has. So I would recommend folks that go to your doctor and ask them about that medication and start taking it.
I have to tell you that that's not true. The medications have been studied in a few small case studies of patients, and it's questionable whether they work. If so, their greatest benefit right now is probably in people that are in the stage of going from being in the hospital to needing to be on a ventilator. And if they are effective, that's the group that will need them to maybe keep them alive. It's very dangerous to ask your doctor for them or to try and get your hands on them because these are not safe medications. They actually interfere with the electrical system of your heart and can put your heart into what's called heart block, where it doesn't beat, and they can cause heart attacks. So they are not safe medications. In addition, these are life-saving medications for patients out there with rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, a variety of other autoimmune diseases that are on very carefully controlled doses. And there's been problems in the United States since this rumor has gone around with these patients that need them to stay alive, not being able to get them. This has been such a problem that Oregon Pharmacy Board, as of yesterday, instituted a rule that nobody in Oregon can get these medications unless their doctor gives them a diagnosis of one of these illnesses that require it for their autoimmune disease. And yes, there are some doctors and nurses that have bought this. It is a very tiny amount of the people, but, you know, we have bad people in this profession as well. I think they're nervous because of the amount of doctors and nurses that are getting sick and even dying from this. So they're at much, much, much higher risk than anybody else. I still hope they don't use it because if you take it outside of a controlled setting, you're probably running a chance of making yourself die from a heart attack, as that may be higher risk than helping your COVID-19.
Question, KJ7JYJ.
Let's see, we've got Kilo Juliet 7, Golf Yankee Juliet, is that right?
Juliet, Yankee Juliet, with a question.
Okay, sorry, you got to do the phonetics for me there. G's sound like J's. Yeah, go ahead with your question.
Okay, well, anyway, my name's Jeff, to the doctor there. So all the media outlets on TV tonight are wrong. They're incorrect on, there's four different channels that have said the studies they're doing with this medication is working. So all the media coverage is wrong tonight. Is that correct? Is that what I'm hearing?
I don't watch the media coverage. Instead, what I go to is the New England Journal of Medicine, to Lancet, to the Journal of American Medical Association. I'm reading actually all the research that is being published as it comes out every day. I went through it all at 4 o'clock this afternoon. There was no new research released at that point in time on it. I went through it all maybe 4 days ago before that, when this drug first came talking about it, and that's the basis of what I'm telling you. There have not been any new studies released yet. There are studies being done, but the results are not actually, they're not there yet. There was one case in China where they reported 5 patients that they treated with it that they thought got better, but they didn't compare them to any patients that weren't treated with it. And since you could pretty much choose any 5 patients out there and have them get better, most people that have looked at that study from a scientific point of view don't find it very valuable. And so far, that's the only study that has even suggested a possible benefit.
Okay, well, thank you. Appreciate that, because just out of 4 of the media tonight on television is saying that things are working in New York, and they just got a new study out of France tonight also. I guess Dr. Oz or somebody was talking about it. Anyway, it was just curious where we're coming from, because we're hearing different stories. Thank you. Appreciate it. KJ7JYJ.
W7EET.
The mainstream media.
Okay, KJ7GB. Got a little bit of trouble there. So let's do it one at a time here. I think I heard Ivan in there. Ivan, go ahead.
No, you can't trust the mainstream media. We need to rely on our scientists and our medical personnel, as in Dr. Sheila here, who has done a phenomenal job in directing us correctly to what we can and cannot do. But if you watch the news, they got this chloroquinine stuff that's supposed to be good for this, that, the other thing, and I want to hear it from a real doctor what we can or cannot take that may help. I'm a proponent for natural stuff to help us. You know, we got plants and herbs and stuff that are all good for us, but if we get the ick, we have to rely on a doctor, and up to this point, their Dr. Sheila has the pretty good know as to what we can and cannot do to help us relieve or abate the symptoms and get rid of it. W7IVN.
K5CPC.
Still got Gene in there.
Okay, let me check in, Mike. And Mike, you're gonna have a follow-up question. Let's have Sheila comment back on that study that was just reported, so she can look it up that fast and tell you about it.
Again, the study in France, it may be in the media today, but it's not brand new today. What it was a study of 20 patients where they did a swab to measure the amount of virus in their nose. But again, they didn't compare against people that they didn't treat with the medicine. They just said compared to the general data out there, they thought that they detected less virus. I haven't read the details of that study, but just looking at that statement concerns me, because one of the things we've discovered with using nasal swabs for testing, and this is not well known, but at best when we are doing these tests that you hear about, that all our case counts are based on, they're based by swabbing somebody's nose. And we are beginning to realize that they're only showing the right answers 60 to maybe 80% of the time, depending upon how good the person is at doing the nose swab. So determining whether a medicine works because of what you measure on a nose swab is not a good way of determining it. Now, I will say, again, there is some reasons to hope that these meds will work, but because they are dangerous, they need to be studied more. And there is actually some very good studies going on right now in several countries around the world trying to look at these medications in a very controlled setting. And if they're beneficial within a couple of weeks, we might know. But they will, again, probably be used for people that are in the hospital, not for people who are likely to get over it on their own.
Okay, and this is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo, special edition of the Emergency Preparedness Net. Let's see. Gene, did you have a follow-up question there?
Yes, I just want to make one more statement and I'll leave. While I was in Vietnam, we took that same medication daily. Why? Because I was in a malaria-infested area in Vietnam. And we had to take that, and the guys that didn't take it, they guess what they got? They got malaria. So I came out of okay. I'm 71 now, and I had no ill effects from that from using that medication. But we only took it once a day, and it was looked like a horse pill, in fact, a white one. I thought I might let you know that. All right, well, thank you. W7AET.
This medication is used for malaria, but when we give it to soldiers or they give it in countries where they need it for malaria, they know what else the people are taking. One of the problems that makes this a dangerous medication is that it interacts a lot with many, many, many other commonly used medications. It's also much more dangerous if you have any underlying heart disease, including the kind that you might not even be aware of, but starts showing up as we get older. So it is considered a much riskier drug if people are on any other medications, if they don't know what they're doing regarding dosing, or if they're old enough to have either known or might have unsuspected heart disease underlying. And that's why it's so important that people don't go out and start taking this medication, because it is dangerous, and there actually have been some deaths in the world already from people trying to take the chloroquine and the hydroxychloroquine on their own.
KJ7 NML, radio check.
Yeah, Kilo Tulia 7, November, Mike Lima, is that correct? Okay, you're not coming back to me. You might be talking on the wrong side of the repeater. We're having Annette here, and if you want to check in or ask a question, that's great. But you're not coming back to me.
Have another question. K6SCF.
CBC, I think you forgot me.
Yeah, let's go on to Mike, since you've got a couple questions in there. Alrighty, Dan, let's see what Mike has to say first here. KGSEP 7GDB here with Emergency Prayers Net. Go ahead, Mike, EPC.
Yes, some 10 years ago, I was pronounced 40 months to live with stage 4 cancer. I have survived those years by using off-prescription drugs that were prescribed for the prostate cancer and used for other things in studies. I'm a great proponent of the right to try, and I don't know how anybody could get their hands on this drug without a doctor taking a look at what you're taking and not knowing what would interact with it. So I don't quite know how to take that. So back to you.
Again, all I can say is that right now these are considered experimental drugs. They are prescription only. The directive to physicians nationally is to not give these for COVID-19 until there is more research, and that there is also a shortage of the drugs for people that need them for ongoing chronic problems. And so until those issues have been solved, the recommendation is that nobody take these for COVID-19 so that the people that have a disease that really need it can continue to take it, and that nobody will take it inappropriately and end up having heart attacks or heart arrhythmias as a result of it. And that's just the way it's going to be for right now, because we don't have enough for everybody to try it. And I know these drugs, they are risky. And when I've always had patients that are interested in trying things that are not standard treatments, the rules that I tend to follow is it going to be harmful and is it going to break your pocketbook? And if it's not going to be harmful and it's not going to break their pocketbook and people want to try alternative therapies and things like that, I'm not usually going to prescribe them, but I have no problem with it. However, when people are using a medication that I think has the risk of harming them, I'm going to speak up against it. And these are not benign medications.
Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, and that's the repeater ID. So we want to go on to the next topic. We talked a lot about the medical part and the treatment part, the trials underway. Let's go on to a little bit more about our environment, because there's some very interesting data about the way that this particular pathogen behaves in our environment. New studies come out about how long it lives and what it does. So let's have a little discussion about that. Here's Sheila.
So for those that we talked about some of this on Tuesday, but again, just kind of a reminder of what we know. We don't know for sure, but because this is a laboratory study, but as best we can tell, virus on cardboard and presumably virus on other types of paper seems to die completely within 24 hours, whereas virus on plastic and glass, other smooth surfaces like that, has been detected for up to 3 days. However, I have to admit, the amount that's detected goes down drastically. So how do you interpret that? There is a slight risk that if you have a smooth surface and other people have touched it, that the virus could be on it. It's not a high risk, but if you're trying to be careful, you might as well take those cautions as well. And in my blog article, I talked about how you can use a hot zone in your house to put everything that comes from the outside there, and nothing that touches the outside leaves there without either having sat for 24 hours to kind of decontaminate if it's paper or being wiped off or cleaned in some way. It just keeps all the potential infectious things right at the entrance to your house. It makes the rest of your house much more comfortable to live in because you don't feel like you're worried about touching things all the time. Does anybody have any questions about how to do that?
CPC.
Okay, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, what if you, two things. If you iron your mail and or if you, a cardboard surface or paper surface, use a Lysol or some sort of disinfectant thing on it, and then dry it. Are those good effective methods?
Well, as far as heating goes, we do know with temperature, currently it's looking like something has to be at 147 degrees for 3 minutes to kill the coronavirus. I have a feeling your newspaper or your mail would not handle that very well. 3 minutes with an iron scorches most things I know. As far as Lysol, if it's something you could spray, I don't know, because cardboard has all those little nooks and crannies on it. In general, I would just not touch things for 24 hours. If I did have to touch them, I wouldn't freak. I would try to have them touch as few things in my house as possible. And then after I was done with them, whatever the cardboard was or the mail was or the newspaper was, after I was done with that, I'd throw it in the trash. I would clean off the surface with a good cleaner and a disinfectant wipe, and I'd wash my hands, and that would be fine. I wouldn't worry about it that much. I think it's good to think about the things that can contaminate our world, but I don't think we need to be obsessive about them.
Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. Any other questions on the hot zone? I think we talked about people going off to work. Let's say you have someone in your family who is a nurse or a doctor or a you know, blood drawer, someone in the healthcare community that is going out there on the front lines of this thing, and they go to work and they come back. You know, maybe we can address what they should do when they come back or how they should behave around the others in their house.
This also has to do with you have people who are still working in your family and things. And it goes back a little bit to the previous blog article of Your House is Your Fortress. And basically, the person in your house that has the highest risk from what they're doing outside pretty much gives the risk to everybody else in the house, unless there's some way of separating people. So I was just having the conversation with a good friend of mine whose husband is a doctor. And as he starts to see hospital patients, his risk is going up significantly. And so we were talking about can they share a house anymore? He already has a different bedroom and a bathroom that he uses. She makes his food, but she doesn't like make him eat it in his room. And they still watch TV together but sit on opposite ends of the couch. And so far that's probably been okay, but as he becomes exposed to more and more COVID patients in the hospital, I recommended that they actually don't even have that much contact anymore because his risk is going to go up significantly of having the virus, and he may not even know it. But if people are working in your household, say they still got a job outside, they work at a store, a grocery store. We have a lot of people still doing that. It really depends upon what their environment is like. If they are having to break that six-foot rule, they're not getting to wash their hands, they're handling a lot of things, and that's more than the rest of the people in the house are experiencing, you might want to think about putting some boundaries between them and the rest of the house. Particularly if somebody in the household is prone to getting more sick, somebody's older, above the age of 60, or has underlying medical problems, sometimes you have to start thinking about literally creating different zones in your house for people that are at lower risk and higher risk.
Still have a question going back to another situation, K6SDS.
CCM was a more general question.
Okay, we'll take Dan's question first, and then Bruce, you'll be next.
How is Salem really set up for ventilators? Do they really have hardly any, or like just maybe one or two, or how tight are we?
Salem Health is pretty good. Because of the fact that we are the regional medical center, it's a pretty big hospital to start with, and I think they have somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 ventilator beds that they could expand to if needed. So I think if they get the normal amount of patients, they will do well. The only concern I have is that I don't know if people look at the numbers. I am a fanatic at looking at the numbers and doing analysis of them, is that Marion County's numbers are going up a lot faster than anybody else's in the state. And I think there is some risk that Marion County is going to turn out to be a hot spot. And I'm hoping that we put in all the social distancing by making everybody stay home early enough that we won't ever get to the point of medical surge here. But looking at the numbers, if any place in the state was going to get in trouble, it would probably be Marion County. I'm glad we have Salem Health here as opposed to many other hospitals. I'm pretty aware of their preparedness, and they're as good as they can possibly be. But if we really had a massive increase in Marion County, that would be bad.
CDC with a comment about ventilators.
Okay, Mike, so let's take Bruce's question first, and because I want to talk a little, get through the environmental stuff before we go back to the ventilators. Bruce, you had a question?
Yeah, just general and quick. University of Washington's latest prognosis shows this peaking here regionally about April 21st and then declining to approximately 1 July. In other words, the lockdown, and it's kind of loose, you have to admit. It's not a, you know, really a hard lockdown like we'd like to see. I would have to continue to at least 1 July. University of Washington, to the state of Washington, projecting about 1,460 deaths in Washington. I would have to assume, prorated on population, that Oregon would follow a similar pattern. Do you agree with that prognosis, W7CCM?
We've reached the point where it's difficult to use the models anymore. The models were really strong when we hadn't added social distancing to it. But now we had a period of time where we had some social distancing where you couldn't be in groups of 250, and then we closed the schools, and then you couldn't be in groups of 10, and we closed the restaurants and the bars. And finally we went to, you know, shelter at home unless you work in an essential work setting, whatever that may be. And every time we do that, it changes the modeling in a way that we're not really certain of. All I can say is that I do think there is a good chance that the social distancing we put in here will keep us from getting above medical surge, which means getting to the situation where you don't have ventilators and some people die because they can't get medical care. I have pretty good faith that that will be effective here. But when we do that, the cost of that is that it spreads out the whole process much longer. And you need to, because if you get surge, you basically lose your health care for everybody, not just COVID-19. You lose it for heart attacks. You lose it for car accidents. But you have to do that. But it's not going to be over in a couple of weeks. It's going to be a slow increase to peak, which will be somewhere April, May, and then a slow fade off. And what we choose to do as a society in terms of figuring out how to bring people back to work is going to have a lot of effect on that.
Okay, KG7, GDB. This is the special edition of the Emergency Preparedness Net. And let's see, one last thing I wanted to mention about that we didn't talk about on environment is had to do with laundry, that a person that does work in one of these riskier situations should probably put their laundry in the hot zone and maybe keep a robe nearby and make sure you launder stuff. Laundry is supposed to be very good at getting rid of the nice warm water and soap washing. We'll get rid of the virus, but you don't want to bring that into the main environment. So it's a hot item. If your shoes, things like that, should stay there, and have a set of house clothes that you wear. Wash your hands. Okay. Now, Mike, you had a question about ventilators.
Yeah, I just saw a piece on the network news about an outfit called DigiKey that has come up with a new kind of ventilator. I thought that was interesting. Is that the same? It looked to me like the same logo as the DigiKey that we use in ham radio.
I'll have her look that one up for you while we're talking. I have seen several articles. There's one on ARRL that was talking about how some hams were trying to come up with different designs for ventilators. There have been reports that, like, the Dyson vacuum cleaner, people are going to try to make some ventilators. I guess they are trying to work on getting ventilators built, but we are trying to innovate. That's one of the things that's great about us is that maybe we can innovate ourselves and get some ventilators going quickly, but we certainly need them in places like New York right now where they are very short of ventilators. She's looking that up. she's not finding finding that particular one. So if you find that, you can go ahead and send that to me. If you find a reference, I'll forward it to her and she can take a look. But I do know that people are trying to invent different kinds of ventilators.
W1ARK, question.
Okay, and there's Robert, Whiskey 1, Alfa Romeo Kilo. Go ahead with your question.
Many homes and businesses have the heating system convection current, which makes the air rise over warm, and that may flow to other rooms. Can this carry the virus right along with it? Take central heating. Can the virus pass through the heating filters scattered all over the house?
That's actually something that we've been looking at very closely as a scientific community, and as best we can tell, the answer is probably no. The majority of this virus acts like a droplet, which means it goes out in a little cloud from you. Most of it goes 3 feet. Some of it might go 6 feet, and then it falls pretty quickly to the ground. There is some thought that a little bit of it may float around in the air. The most we've known is that in a small patient room where they did some studies, they did manage to find it on, they found very, very low concentrations of it on an air vent. But generally, the environmental studies they're doing are not showing that it's getting into ventilation systems at all. So the amount of virus, if it's in the air, is probably pretty limited, and that's something they've been watching very closely. I worry a little bit when people sit together in a small room for a period of time that there may be enough virus, but I definitely don't worry that there's enough virus to get moving through a ventilation system at this time.
Q1VIN, next question.
W7MTL with the question.
India Victor November, question.
K9RCP with a motion.
Okay, I can only do, I think, three at a time here. Let's see. We got VIN with a question. I do then Ivan and one other, and I can't remember the third one. So let's just take VIN first.
Yes, a question for Sheila there, and thank you so much for your time. I saw a report. Now, it came through, you know, as some of us do, see it through Facebook, that there were possibly a chance of correspondence between taking ibuprofen to reduce your fever amidst the high fever side of COVID and taking Tylenol, that they have found a higher death rate with that. Is that something valid, or have you heard anything about it, and should I just forget it and not really spread it around? Doesn't matter.
Yeah, that one made the rounds of every social media, and there is no basis in fact to that one at all. Nobody can quite figure out where it came from, supposedly from some doctor that reported it, but it is considered amongst the medical community to be fake news. There's no sign that ibuprofen is a problem. It's being used regularly in hospitals and is very essential to use.
Thank you. And your other one was MCL there, Brett. K1VIN.
Okay, let's do MCL next. I do want to have time to make a comment about, we saw, speaking of fake news, there have been reports. Let me just get this one out real quick before because it's important that we don't do the wrong thing. So there was a YouTube video, making your own paper mask, you know, out of a paper towel. I wanted Sheila to address the issue of what masks can be used and what can't be used, and the homemade masks. Okay, let's get that real quick from her.
First of all, you have to separate the idea of what a mask would be used for if you were directly caring for a patient either in your home or as a healthcare provider versus where the goal is to not get sick versus a mask if you are sick and you don't want to get anybody else sick. First of all, paper is crud for all of that, at least paper towels and the papers that you can have. It doesn't block virus very well at all, either going in or going out. That's why the surgical masks have to be made out of special materials. If you want to do homemade masks for yourself or your loved ones to wear when they think they're sick so that they never get to put that virus particles out in the cloud around them, that's when fabric masks might be helpful. And they're recommending several layers of fabric. It has to fit tightly around your face so air can't leak out. And if you were sick and you were wearing one, it might help protect the people around you. The better thing would just not to have anybody around you, but sometimes you need caregiving. And so in that circumstance, that's when I would recommend homemade masks. The hospitals are getting donations of homemade masks. Most of those are being used for visitors that have to come in and sit with a sick patient, or they're being used for staff that do not do direct patient care because they're not really thought to be effective at blocking somebody from getting sick. So you can make them if you want. I will say, you know, Salem Health had mask kits. Those were actually designed in combination with some work done by the University of Washington Material Science and Nike to actually be able to be made at home and be used for healthcare providers. But they've got to come from a healthcare institution for a homemade mask to be considered for use.
BBC.
Okay, Mike, I got to put you on the deck here. I got Ivan still has a question out there, I think. Let's hear what his question was.
Thank you, Brett. My girl wants to know, because I'm kind of on her page as well, what are the statistics annually flu compared to coronavirus, which seems to be far less. Granted, we have all been locked up in our houses for, I don't know, a week, 2 weeks, but still, what annually, let's say 3 years ago, what was the annual death rate compared to the coronavirus versus flu?
I have the statistics written down somewhere, but I would have to hunt them down. But let me explain in general why it's different. Influenza is something we know about, we're prepared for. Hospitals actually keep wards of beds available for what we consider influenza season. And so the system is very well designed around handling influenza. In a bad year in the United States with influenza, we might get as many as, and again, I'm trying to remember the exact numbers, there might be 40,000 people, maybe even 50,000 people that die from influenza over the period of time from October through March. In a good year, it might be 12,000. So the numbers look relatively comparable, but we're ready for it. We know how to handle it. It's very well spread out over time. It's spread out over space. Most of those people are in the hospital, even the ones that die, are not in the hospital for very long. The other part with influenza is on the scale of things not very infectious. So if you have one person with influenza, they're likely to infect maybe one more person. With this one, it infects 2.5 more people. In addition, most of the people with influenza don't require hospitalization. Trying to remember, I think it's about 1% of the people with influenza have to go in a hospital at all over that whole six-month season, whereas with COVID-19, hospitalization rates are running between 15 to 20% of the people that get sick end up in the hospital. So that's the problem. It's that it's all coming at once. It's coming very, very quickly, and the hospitalization needs are so intense, they're overwhelming our system. When somebody goes to the hospital with COVID-19, they are generally in the hospital for 7 to 21 days. So that's to survive it. And even the ones that die, they're working on them sometimes for 7 or 14 days even before they die. So they have very long hospitalizations. So the big difference is it's just so much more intense on our healthcare system. The total numbers of how many die in the long run, I don't know how they're going to compare. But I do know that if we don't control it, it's going to destroy our healthcare system. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Sheila. You're amazing. I appreciate your time every couple of days here instructing and teaching us. W7IVN.
JLO.
Craig had a question.
Okay, we're 8:06, so we can take one more question. But remember, you can send in questions. You can email them to me at kilogolf7golfdeltabravo@arrl.net, and I'll forward them to her. You can put the questions on the WA7ABU groups.io, or you can go to disasterdoc.net, and you can click the little contact button at the top of the page, and that will go right to her. So a couple different ways to ask questions between tonight and Tuesday. And so let's take the last question, but see, was it Jeff that was on there?
MTL.
Yeah, who had the question? I know I heard STX, you got several questions there. Was there somebody else that didn't get to answer, ask a question that wanted to ask one?
PCC, MTL.
Okay, so we got CPC, who got several questions to answer tonight. Craig, we didn't answer your question. Go ahead, Craig.
Yeah, I'll keep it short and simple. Vitamin C, I hear people are taking high-dose vitamin C, like 1,000 milligrams a day. Can that help prevent the disease or with the symptoms if you get it?
There is no evidence one way or the other that it's going to help or hurt. Vitamin C has been recommended, you know, as a, I don't want to call it alternative or a natural treatment for colds and flus for a long time. No evidence one way or the other. On the other hand, it won't hurt you. So, you know, some people, if they take that much vitamin C, get diarrhea. Well, that's your choice. But it's not going to do you any harm to take that much vitamin C other than maybe upset your stomach a little bit. So if you want to go for it, go for it. But there is no evidence that it's going to make any difference. Doesn't mean you can't do it.
Okay, thank you, W7MT.
Can I interview people with a question?
Okay, well, all right. So, Richard, I want to actually go ahead and close the net because it's after 8 now. We're at 8:08, and we can come back and do that again, or you can text me, and I can get the question to her that way. But we really ought to be fair to other people and to the doctor here who's not sleeping at night, you know, to get her home. But anyway, so I'm going to go ahead and close the net, and, you know, we'll field other questions if we can via email messages or whatever, okay? Sorry about that. But we'll do it again on Tuesday, 7 o'clock, you know, same time, same frequency, right?
Indeed. Thanks, Doc. We appreciate you so much. You have no idea. W7IVN.
Okay, she said... Thank you. Okay, the time's now 8:09 p.m., and this concludes the 529 Emergency Preparedness Net Special Edition for Friday night. We'll meet again on Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on 145.29. And our thanks, of course, tonight go out to Dan, WA7ABU, for the use of the repeater. Thanks to all the callers who participated today and those who stood by to give us a clear channel. There should be a recording of this, which will appear on the WA7ABU.com webpage, and you can listen to it again if you missed something. And again, send those questions in, and they might appear either in the blog or we'll talk about them on Tuesday. So In the meantime, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, closing the net now at 8:10 p.m. We now return the repeater to normal undirected amateur operations. Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. Thank you, everyone.